Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now are Dr. Tom Mankin, the president and CEO of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and Roger Zackheim, the director of the Ronald Reagan Institute, to discuss their joint report warning lawmakers that a 10% cut to national defense would devastate U.S. warfighting capabilities. The National Defense Industrial Association supported the effort. Gentlemen, great to have you both back on.
Great to be with you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
An absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. First, Roger, I have to say I'm very, very sorry the Reagan Forum was canceled last year, and I'm hoping that vaccinations or anything else, including driving across country, allow us all to convene at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum next year for the conference. So I just want to start that off.
Well, thanks, Vago. Disappointed it couldn't happen in December, and we're looking forward to getting it back on track.
Absolutely. It's one of the true gems on the agenda every year, and I know that everybody really, really missed it. Tom, start us off a little bit on the study. Certainly, there were prominent Democrats, including the new chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, who goes without saying came in second in the presidential race to Joe Biden, or I should say the primaries on the Democratic side. They've called for a 10% defense budget cut that has got some traction also in the House. Ultimately, though, there's this sense for bipartisan consensus for defense. But this is a scenario you guys wargamed out using a lot of cold, hard math and strategy. Walk us through the study and what the findings were.
Yeah, of course, Vago. Yeah, you know, I think we started to hear calls for radical shifts to the defense budget in the middle of last year because of COVID, because of the state of the U.S. economy. And what we wanted to do is really explore the impact of shifts in the defense budget. So what we did was we got together some serving and former policymakers, serving and former members of Congress, folks from the kind of the think tank world, folks from industry, and held a series of workshops using the CSBA's strategic choices tool to try to look at the impact of different budget scenarios. And it really is the most recent in a series of exercises that we've done using our strategic choices tool. And in this case, we were really honored and pleased to team with the Reagan Institute and run these exercises.
And talk to us a little bit about the scenarios, right? So one was a 10% budget cut scenario. The other one was a 3% increase. Talk to us about what each of these does for U.S. Defense.
Yeah, so the 3% increase, that goes back to former Secretary Mattis, former Chairman Dunford. What they said was necessary to fully fund the existing national defense strategy. So that was our first scenario. And then, a number of folks had begun to talk about a 10% cut. So we used that second scenario as the boundary on the other end. You want to force people to really look hard at different components of the budget. You want to force people to take a hard look at serious strategic choices. So those are the two scenarios that we looked at. We ran two different events. Each event included two teams. So we really had four different teams looking at these different scenarios. And there were some commonalities in terms of the things that folks believed needed more investment. And there were some commonalities as well, particularly in the 10% cut scenario. Of where they felt we needed to get money to meet that budget target.
Can I just add, Vago?
Roger.
Yeah,
of course.
Two things here that I think are important and explain why the Reagan Institute really wanted to collaborate with Tom and CSBA on this. As you know, the Reagan Institute for years and with the Reagan National Defense Forum has hosted and facilitated budget debates. And frankly, they just get stale. The same talking points are rehashed time and time again. And it's just clear that we weren't making much progress on that. So with this tool that Tom described, and I'm sure we'll go into more detail on, it really goes away from, you know, the standard talking points and forces people just to confront with, you know, this particular programs and the major strategic choices that they have to kind of wrestle with. So that's why this, to me, is the kind of the best in class way to have a budget discussion. Second point, and this really explains the scenarios, you know, going ahead and simply doing the choices with the current program of record, which by the end of the Trump administration was essentially a flat line, you know, and Tom has made this point, is really not adding to the discussion. What we wanted to do was explore areas that we felt hadn't really been looked at significantly or sufficiently.
So let me carry that forward, Roger. You guys model two scenarios, right? I mean, the 10% cut and then the 3% increase. But now there seems to be a consensus that it might be actually flat minus about 2.1% inflation adjustment, right? So an effective 2.1% cut. You know, why didn't you guys model that scenario? And conversely, what are the implications of that scenario, right? And let's start off with you as a former House Armed Services Committee Deputy Staff Director, right? What are the implications of something that's not quite the hard cut? It's not the increase. It's sort of a grinding reduction.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the impact of that, if you're not growing, right, staying flat, as you pointed out, essentially means that you're shrinking. And yeah, you mentioned the Congress. And one thing I take away from my time as a staffer is that the last thing the Congress will want to do is to reduce kind of civilian workforce and end strength, guard, and other things. The point is that the net effect when you have this, you know, 2% cut that you've described, Vago, is that modernization pays the bill first. And that point I've just made is not only applicable to the scenario you're asking about, this 2% cut, but it's also true in a 10% cut. And one of the things that was quite notable in our 10% scenario is that these strategic-minded policymakers and elected officials made choices that were sound in terms of doing their best to support a defense strategy, but in reality, probably did not reflect how the Congress would dispose of a similar cut, because Congress, if you know the past is prologue, will not allow for significant reductions to the workforce in the fashion that a lot of our participants advocated for.
Yeah, to build off of that, you know, I mean, when we get to the 10% cut scenario, you know, to get the funds, the teams had to either engage in kind of politically naive assumptions that they themselves acknowledge were politically naive, or to make cuts that were, you know, that have historically proven to be politically unpalatable. So as Roger says, large cuts to personnel, civilian and military, cuts to modernization, not because they wanted to, but there's only so much money to be saved from cutting so-called legacy systems.
Right.
And then, you know, cutting US presence overseas. So I think the utility of that 10% cut scenario, however realistic or not, and I certainly hope it's not politically viable, but it reveals, you know, just the type of difficult choices that will arise in one form or another when we're talking about cuts.
Well, I want to get to difficult choices in a moment, because there is this, right? I mean, we've been talking about big trade-offs for years and the necessity of doing that. The Bush administration was talking about it, right? Let's skip a generation. Let's get to that next generation of combat capability. And instead, we don't quite sunset capability, in part because there are members and it's the only military unit in their district or what have you. Tom, let me start you off with this. You were a former Deputy Assistant Secretary under Eric Edelman, who's also at CSBA when he was the Undersecretary. Why does fulfilling the National Defense Strategy matter, right? It is a great document. There's universal acclaim for it, bipartisan support for it, but it's a Trump document. We're now in a Biden administration. And the other thing is, we've never as a nation supported any of these strategies appropriately. We underfund these strategies all the time. In fact, Eric and Gary Roughead were on the panel that said, you know, we're hundreds of billions of dollars short supporting this strategy, even with a rosy budget projection. I mean, isn't the Washington answer to this to just rewrite a new strategy that justifies a lower level of spending?
Well,
especially if you're living a lie anyway, in a sense.
Well, we use the existing National Defense Strategy as the starting point. What we asked the participants in our workshops to do, really as the first step, was to modify it. So we weren't, we weren't genuflecting to the existing National Defense Strategy. We were using it as a starting point. But what I would say about it is that the essentials. I think the essentials are what matter. So the fact that we live in an era dominated by competition with China and Russia, right? The fact that at the very least we need to be able to fight one war and deter another. Although even there, I think that maybe, you know, historically we've prepared to actually wage two wars at once. And we've already, you know, we've already backed off of that in recent administrations. So those seems to me those are some of the big, you know, the big movements that the need to have overseas basing and forward deployed forces. The fact that we are a global power, you know, we're not a regional power, merely a regional power, whether we're talking about Asia, Europe, or what have you, we're a global power. So I think those are facts, right? And we can talk about how those facts come to play in the existing national defense strategy or the one that will follow. But I think those big building blocks are important. And to the idea that we never fully fund, I'll paraphrase, that we're never strategically solvent, you know, that's whistling past the graveyard. I mean, that's all fine and good until our forces are, you know, are put to the test. And, you know, it's up to leaders in the executive branch, leaders in the legislative branch. I mean, they bear the ultimate responsibility for ensuring that we are prepared. We're prepared for an uncertain future.
Vago, I just want to add, I really disagree with your premise, both in terms of this defense strategy, national defense strategy, of course, falls out of the national security strategy. And then on the funding piece. So, you know, I'll play ZACOM here and do the spirited debate that I know your listeners are used to with the family genes playing out. But this defense strategy is fundamentally different for, you know, the reasons that Tom outlined. I mean, the shift to great power competition, the focus on China, and to a lesser extent, at least during the Trump years, on Russia, that's here to stay. And the department, took the resource it was given, perhaps not enough as Mattis and Dunford asked for, and applied it against those resources. That all happened because of a strategy document that really shifted from what it, you know, previously inherited. I'm not seeing that fundamental shift change with this administration, you know, and my sense is you would agree with that too. And in terms of the funding piece, you know, it's you're still getting more towards those strategic objectives than not. And I think the question for the Biden administration is, one, will they have to shift the strategy? Will they choose to shift the strategy? And will there be any attempt to reconcile the strategy with the budget on their part and what puts and takes they make? Those are all kind of the live questions, which we'll see in the not too distant future, the administration answer.
And just to go back, I completely agree, right? I mean, the strategy was evolutionary and did become much harder, correctly so, against China and Russia. My only point, Roger, is that at the end of the day, we put great strategy documents down, but, and yes, they do shape investment, right? I mean, just like the Obama administration's strategy shaped investment, the trouble is we never invest in them the way that we should invest them to realize them, right? And so we tend to put, not to sound too much like H.R. McMaster, but we have a degree of sort of strategic narcissism in how we go about this, how some problems are going to be easier. And even then we make some intellectual trade-offs that may be somewhat unrealistic, right? That we're never going to have as much budget. We're never going to have the troops, but we become wedded to the idea we're going to fight two wars simultaneously, which is, you know, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, those wars consumed the kind of resources that pale in comparison to what would happen with China. I mean, that's kind of my more my point is either you got to acknowledge we need to be spending $1 trillion a year or, you know, something else. And my concern is that we just don't just say, you know what? Yeah, it's going to cost us $1 trillion.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead, Tom.
We're just going to have to do a lot less, right?
But I think, you know, I think part of the problem, and Vago, I think you're typifying it here, is that we start with a budget number, you know, so we say, oh, it's gonna, you know, it's gonna cost $1 billion, or oh, we need this, and fundamentally, what we, you know, what we did in this project was, we had budget targets that the teams had to work towards, but to get there, they really had to focus on capabilities. So right. I think, you know, our way of looking at this and, you know, getting to the budget figures was to say, okay, well, what is it that we're going to need to do? And then how much is that going to cost? I think too often, you know, in Washington, give me a budget and I'll build you the force. And I think that ultimately does a disservice to the leaders in the executive and legislative branches. The answer, the question should be, what do we need to do to safeguard our national security? What are the capabilities? What are the concepts that are needed to do that? And then how much will that cost? And then is that affordable? Is that politically feasible?
Yeah, and just to build on that.
That's the order in which we try to tackle these things.
It'll be a shock to listeners, but I agree with you. And I would add that, you know, this new defense strategy, and it's still new, hasn't had, the benefit of decades of operational concepts being developed underneath it, hasn't tested, piloted capabilities that would most effectively deliver the strategic objectives. All that is work that started in the previous administration needs to continue and could actually deliver significant, kind of budget decisions with respect to different programs. I mean, that is a suite of work that's underway, but in not even close to being finished. So, you know, that's another kind of set of points, Vago, that lend to kind of the argument that this strategy is a real shift and there's more work to be done. The kind of out year impact in terms of on the budget is still unknown.
Each one of these strategies, as somebody who's read all of them and commentated on them and covered them and talked to folks much smarter than I am about them. I mean, they are evolutionary, right? There were things that were, you know, as the Obama strategy changed, there was a sense whether or not it was going to be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, we were going to get harder on China. We were going to get harder on Russia, where there were going to be new capabilities we're going to need, right? I mean, the great thing about the system is that if some of the foundational elements always remain the same, the threat changes and we adapt to it. The question I would ask to you, Roger, right, but at the end of the day, right, strategy is how best to use available resources. Republicans, you know, when it looked like Donald Trump was not going to win, Republicans started talking more about, you know, well, we've got to be financially conscious, right? So people who had sort of lost the will for financial discipline, all of a sudden are back to saying debt is important, right? We've commented on this on the weekly podcast now for, you know, going on a year. you know, and I, you were up there on the Hill actually when the Budget Control Act came down, because, you know, a small number or actually a sizable number of the Republican caucus were like, hey, we're going to cleanse the House through fiscal fire. And so we ended up with a Budget Control Act because nobody wanted to default on the debt. Right. We've got more debt votes that are coming up. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, how does this work? And how do we manage to get the most defense, which also means trade-offs, right? I mean, the nightmare scenario is that progressives and Freedom Caucus Republicans get together to jam play defense, and then it's you, and then you'll be lucky to get out of it with a 10% cut.
Well, I will not kind of debate the narrative of how we got the Budget Control Act. We'll leave that for another session. But I will say
it was too scarring, and you've only recently begun to sleep full nights. So I appreciate that.
That as well. But you know, the nightmare scenario that you've just articulated is a likely scenario. There's no doubt that when it comes to defense, there'll be some unity amongst the left flank of the Democratic Party. And the fiscal hawks and particularly in the House. The reality is, as you know, Vago, it's the President of the United States that sets the terms of debate around the defense budget. Now, that's what the President proposes. Congress disposes, but they only dispose, you know, within a couple of percent in either direction at most from what the President proposes. I mean, you really got to look at the exceptions from where the Congress has done significant kind of damage to the defense budget that the President puts forward. And so that is the most important marker in all this. And we'll tell you, you know, how significant a change you'll get. The President of the United States chooses to indicate that he's open to negotiate on defense. Well, then the President will get that debate, and the forces that you've just, you know, described will have more impact. But it really does reside, for the most part, with what comes out of the White House.
Tom, how does everybody in this system need to think about trade-offs and making the right trade-offs for capability, right? I mean, so even at 3%, it's unlikely that we're going to have as much resources going to the things we need to do as quickly as we need to do them, right? You and I, you've joined us a couple of times over the year, and you know, we've talked about the time window that the United States and its allies have to continue deterring a China that's moving really fast. It's encouraging the administration wants to bring allies and partners together to craft sort of a unitary diplomatic security and economic picture. That said, China already struck a major trade deal with Asia partners as well as with Europe, despite candidate Biden and President-elect Biden calling on him to stop. What's the mindset that's necessary to make the kind of trade-offs? Because even if we get 3%, we're lucky to get 3%, which we're not, it's going to require hard choices. Those choices become harder at -2. They become a lot harder at -10.
Sure. I mean, this is where strategy comes back in, and this is where operational concepts come back in, right? This is where, you know, having a strategy, you know, and priorities. So, you know, preparing, competing with, deterring China as your number one priority, the Indo-Pacific region being your priority theater, for example, and having service concepts and joint concepts for deterrence and for warfighting becomes all the more important, because that's then what tells you, all right, I need to really double down on long range fires, for example. We need to double down on unmanned attritable systems. We need to up our investments in undersea warfare. We need to move forward with nuclear modernization. And oh, by the way, I just gave you the list. That was sort of the consensus, ads for all four teams across this project. Right. And then, you know, once you've done that, then the question is, all right, then what's the trade space? What are the types of things that I might need to cut if there aren't enough resources to safeguard the things that I really need? And again, in the 10% cut, it's pretty ugly. You know, you want to modernize, but you can't modernize because the resources aren't there. Presence is extremely important, but you got to cut manpower. all sorts of things like that. So that's, I think that's the way to go about it. And I think fortunately, you know, we've got, you know, we've got the means with our strategic choices tool to be able to explore, you know, those types of trade-offs.
Roger, you tried to engineer those kind of trade-offs when you were up on the Hill. I mean, what's the trick to getting it right? Because there are a lot of very talented, experienced members that are looking forward to the best outcomes.
I mean, the most interesting part of the trade-offs is this debate over what do you give up from legacy systems, especially when you're going to take that money to invest in something that perhaps only exists on a PowerPoint slide. That's the hard part. And what are you willing, what risk are you willing to absorb in that intervening period when you've given up? Because you got to give up that force structure now, but you have, you know, sometime years where you have to wait for the new capability to come online, all the while knowing that you have challenges today that will require a conventional deterrent that you don't want to walk away from. I mean, that is the interesting discussion. Frankly, it even happens on a 3% scenario. And then also I felt that you had people wanting more modernization, more, you know, R&D investments, at least when it comes to the tool, they exhausted that. And there wasn't more to kind of to more opportunity there. So, you know, what I found both in terms of participating and seeing others participate in this exercise is that friction point of, you know, do you really need, give up a carrier? Do you give up kind of manned, fighter squadrons and the like in favor of concepts that some are just not convinced are ready to go and have the robust investment that others would seek to give to it?
How much room is there for rethinking elements of this problem, right? No matter how much anybody discusses acquisition reform, for example, acquisition does not get reformed that fast, right? We're still talking about, you know, there's this light amphibious warship concept. That's not going to start being fielded for, you know, more than a decade, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we need to rethink what it is we do? Benefits continue to be increased, even though there are a lot of folks who say, hey, look, you know, the benefit train has kind of gone far enough. You know, as I recall, Todd Harrison, who's now at Center for Strategic and International Studies, was still with CSBA at the time and did a study, right, that actually most military people would rather have more bodies and were willing to take less, you know, were willing to trade away pay increases to be able to pay for more end strength at the end of the day, right? And oftentimes the end strength we focus on cutting aren't the commander, right? The O5 and the colonels, which we have a lot of, that are really expensive. Like the enlisted people aren't that expensive. So, I mean, do you think that there's, you know, from the standpoint of either of you, you know, you as a policy and a strategist, Roger, you as a budgeteer or an authorizer, that, you know, how much bandwidth is there, or is it, as many people say, there's just not much to save there. It's just about spending more money, not about rethinking the problem.
I'll start. I think there's a lot of rethinking that can be done, but actually people tend to focus on, let's say, the China and Russia scenarios to drive at it. I think there's a lot that has to be done on the lower end side of the house. Think Middle East, think how you deter Iran. When Tom and I were doing the National Defense Strategy Commission work that you referenced before, where Gary Ruff and Eric Edelman co-chaired, so much of what they wanted to do in the Middle East was not using the language of less, but doing it differently. You know, why are we using high-end, you know, fifth-generation fighters to carry out a mission that lower-end platforms could deliver? Good idea, hasn't happened. A big problem, why hasn't that actually been realized? Right. And that's where you get some of the savings, Vaga, that you're referencing, and actually a lower risk approach to make, you know, it's still an important choice, but the risk is not the same as a China or Russia challenge.
Yeah, and I think part of it is being able to really open up the aperture as to what, you know, the alternatives are. And so I think one of the things, one of the features of our strategic choices tool, and I think one of the features that the participants in this project found really helpful was it not only portrays the program of record, but it also portrays all sorts of developmental hypothetical systems as well. And so you're not just captured by, you know, by the POM. You can actually look at trades of, all right, well, what if we did things very differently? What if we, went to, I don't know, containerized munitions on essentially, a civilian ship hull form? Or what if we went to, very different types of capabilities? And you can actually price those out. Now, of course, you don't wave a magic wand and get them, right? You've got to invest in R&D in the short term to have a chance of unlocking those capabilities in the mid to far term. But without the ability to actually portray those and portray, R&D spending as one way to do that, right? One way to unlock those future capabilities, then you're just kind of, again, you're just arguing about the program of record, and you're just sort of like, adding or subtracting at the margins.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. Absolutely fascinating work. I commend the audience to read it because at the end of the day, if we're going to be making the best decisions for the national defense, it's important to have the kind of thoughtful input you guys have put together. Thanks very, very much for the hard work. Thanks very much for all the time. And you're both welcome on anytime in the future.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Always a pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.